Yeah, so that's how, because we want to fit in all of the presentations. I'm really excited to see what you guys have done. So we have a few guests with us, of course, your mentors, many of them are here. And I also wanted to acknowledge a few people that are joining us today. So we have two guests from MapleSoft, Andrew and Aaron. They were part of the people that donated Maple copies to all of you and were part of the development of the Math Primer that we're working on. So please give them a great thank you. Not like some kind of test by them, right? They're friendly folk, and so really this is just an opportunity for you to present to each other. We don't have anyone, you know, watching over or seeing how you're doing. This is really just a relaxed thing for you guys to share your project before we go downstairs to share it with everyone else at TI, okay? Do I have any volunteers who would like to take the style of being first, or should I just call out a mentor name and that's the first one to go. Anybody would like to go first? All right, Lauren's group.
Superconductors and the ways in which the sort of computers are able to simulate critical temperatures of superconductors. So basically, to start with, what is a superconductor? Basically, a superconductor is any material that when it's cooled below a certain critical temperature, allows electrons to flow through it with zero resistance. So, in other words, no energy is lost as it passes through. I think that Kishan was going to sort of explain how they work.
So as Nate said, in a normal reactor, you have a lattice of your positive neutron, which is represented by the circles. And when you have a normal current going through a normal metal, it consists of electrons, and they'll eventually collide and eventually make their way across the metal, but they interact with the lattice, so that's why you get resistance. But when you lower the temperature for a superconductor, below its critical temperature, there's very little vibrational energy with the lattice. So essentially what happens, as an electron passes through, so as it goes through, because it's negatively charged, it attracts the positive ions very slightly close together. So this, you have a slightly denser region of positive charge. And what that only lasts for a very short period of time. But what that causes is another electron, which is also negatively charged, to be attracted to that area of positive charge. So as you have this electron, the first one moving through, you have another one following it. Essentially, you have a binding energy between these two electrons, and they form like a coupling to like a pair. And this is known as a Cooper pair, after Leon Cooper, who first theorized it. And what's special about it is that a normal electron, as you probably know, is a fermion. And so that means it has a positive integral state. But when they couple together, they essentially act as a boson, which is an integer spin thing. And the importance of that is boson, you have two bosons, they can collapse into the same energy state. So when you have loads of Cooper pairs inside your mental lattice, they all can be described with one single wave function opposed to lots. And this is important as there's very little interaction with the lattice itself. So essentially, electrons can travel through the mental lattice without interacting with it, i.e. having zero resistance, so zero electrical resistance. So that's how superconductivity works.
Great, and so in our simulation, we use these sort of little rotors here that are probably kind of hard to see to simulate the direction sort of the wave of these Cooper pairs. And so you can imagine that having a diagram with them all being aligned would be in a superconductive state, and when they're all random, they would just be above that physical temperature in a regular state.
So our simulations are basically based on the phase coherence of the angles. Right. And after our algorithms and code, the programs that we use to simulate these, they're very difficult to see, but you come up with these sorts of diagrams with a lattice that has the arrows representing the phase. And this first grid that, I'll just start down here. So at high temperatures, you get a lot of randomness, and that's why it's hard to see, but the arrows, the angles are all different, and there's no structure to it. And as you approach the critical temperature, you can see there's lines here that are mostly aligned, but it's still very clearly random. And at very low temperatures, this is 0.0001, there's no unit really, but it's below the critical temperature, and you can see they're all aligned, and that's the phase coherence of the superconductor. And just below it, you get these vortex patterns, where the energy kind of gets stuck almost, kind of say it like that, where it takes, and go back up to this diagram here. See, this is the low energy we're looking at in a vortex configuration. So it needs to go up in this energy to be able to go to a lower energy, so it's just all an energy efficiency where it takes too much energy to get to the lower energy, so it just stays in that vortex. And here, they're very hard to see from far away, but there is an N1 vortex. You can kind of imagine an arrow pointing in this direction, this direction, this direction, this direction, as well as an anti-vortex, which is, sorry, it's very hard to show, but I guess you could draw it. Thank you, Kishan.
That's N1, so it's like a circular pattern. Negative one is, I think it's this.
That's the opposite. So they annihilate when the simulation runs, they get closer and closer together. And they annihilate each other so the pattern can all be uniform.
Perfect. And basically, so one more thing that we did, in essence, the Monte Carlo's algorithm that we use is acts to find the lowest energy state of this pattern. And one more thing that we did to actually see if we could find the critical temperature in the simulation was we calculated stiffness, which basically is a measure of how parallel or random they are. And you can maybe see on this graph here that as we increased the lattice size and ran more simulations, we were able to get very close to the expected critical temperature.
Mm-hmm, right. As for the Monte Carlo match methods, we use a very accurate mathematical motivation in order to get the probability of a state mu turn to state n is divided by probability of state n turning to state mu is a very accurate mathematical equation, and we use that. As for the model we use for Matrola's algorithm in order to figure out the Monte Carlo algorithm. And in that case, we divide into two possibilities. One possibility is the delta energy is less than zero. The probability of the delta energy is, for for a state to turn from new state into end state is very low, but as for energy that is greater, it is very low, but the delta E is less than or equal to zero, the probability for it to turn into another state is very high. So that kind of way would simulate the Monte Carlo.
And that's how we find the lowest energy state. And we're out of time, but if you just look very briefly up there, you can see this is actually an animation of our simulation running. I think this is probably at a fairly low temperature,
yeah.
So you can sort of see some little vortexes forming, but then they annihilate and then they tend to line up.
Awesome.
So that's our
thank you.
All right, you guys are ready? Go for it.
Hello, everyone. Our presentation will be about relativistic quantum information. And based on information we received from our mentor, Paulina, we have decided to make a creative model out of it. The model that we have decided to use is a quantum circuit, shown here. We'll talk about this more throughout our presentation. I'll begin with the question, what is a qubit? A classical bit is either one or a zero. However, a qubit is a quantum analog of a bit. It can be zero, one, or a combination, a superposition of both. While the qubit can be in a quantum state, observing it can only yield classical information, either one or zero with certain probabilities. In practice, a qubit can be implemented by any quantum mechanical system, such as the polarization of laser light or the spin of an electron.
To represent qubits in our theory, we need to develop a mathematical framework. So a qubit is always in a quantum state, which you represent as psi. Psi is a linear combination of the two basis states, 0 and 1, which correspond to the classical 0 and 1. The coefficients alpha and beta of 0 and 1 correspond to the square roots of the probabilities of observing a 0 or a 1 when that quantum state is there. In order to do something with these qubits, we define operators which act on the qubits to change their quantum state. So for example, one of the common operators is the X operator, which acts as a not, changing the state of 1 to the state of 0 and the state of 0 to the state of 1. We represent these quantum states as points in a 2D vector space, such that the state of 0 is written as the vector 1, 0, and the state of 1 is written as the vector 0, 1. In this case, we define our operators as matrices, square matrices, which left multiply the state vector to change it. In order to combine multiple qubits to create a larger quantum system, we need to take the tensor product of the vectors corresponding to their states. This leads to a 2 to the power of n dimensional space for n qubits. With the mathematical framework defined, we can see that there are three things we can do with qubits. So firstly, we initialize them to be either 1 or 0. Then we can apply a sequence of operators to them. And then finally, we measure to yield the classical information, so either a 0 or 1 with probability defined by the state.
So as Pratap was saying, there are operators you can apply to these qubits throughout the circuit. So I will talk about some of those operators now. They're called quantum gates, and the most common gates are the conditional gates, target, Hadamard, CNOT, and Z, and measurement gates. The conditional gate is one that uses the state of a qubit as a control to determine if the gate will carry out its operation as part of the qubit. The target itself is not a gate, but is used as part of the function combination gate or the CNOT gate to affect another qubit, usually by taking the exclusive OR of the function output and the qubit itself. The Hadamard gate transforms the qubit states 0 to plus and 1 to minus, where plus and minus are superposition states between 0 and 1. The CNOT gate is a simple NOT gate. It depends on the state of another qubit in the same way that the conditional gate. The Z gate is another quantum gate that negates the coefficient of the one term in a qubit. And lastly, the measurement gate effectively collapses a qubit, these are measurement gates, to a classical bit. If the input qubit has a value alpha 0 and beta 1, the classical bit has a value 0 with the probability alpha squared and a value 1 with the probability beta squared.
So, why do we need the quantum circuit? In a classical circuit, if you want to measure a bit, if it is a 0 or a 1, you have to use gates which the number of gates increases exponentially with the number of bits that you provide. That is the amount of information. But for a qubit, to measure a qubit, you just need one qubit. For example, here we have the Dosh-Jos-Sav problem. It requires two Hadamard gates and one F8, and all you need to do is just put in two qubits and get the information after measuring just once. So you just need to ask the qubit one question and it tells you what it is without the need for a physical system that actually requires cumbersome setup as such.
Another interesting gate is the Pauli gate. So the Pauli gate is illustrated in this circuit. So when both qubits A and B are 1, the NOT operator is applied to qubit C. And the matrix for the control gate is as shown here, although I think it's a bit small. So basically, in our project, we actually had a problem to figure out how to derive this matrix. So the first step we did was to list all the possible inputs and outputs. For example, 0, 0, 0 would come out as 0, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 1 would come out as 0, 0, 1. But when qubits A and D are both 1, for example 1, 1, 0, then qubit C will be flipped to become 1, 1, 1. And by comparing the basis vectors that correspond to these states, we can determine the form of the matrix, which is essentially the identity matrix for the first 6 rows and the X matrix at the end of the last 2 rows over here. Yeah. We also learned about interferometers, and the circuit diagram is as shown over here. A beam splitter applies the transformation to two qubits, where T represents transmitted and R represents reflected, and the phase shifter applies the following transformation to a qubit. Sorry, it's a bit small. And these two components can be combined to form the Mach-Zehnder interferometer as shown. So if we actually apply all these operations and follow the path in the circuit, we are able to calculate the probabilities of finding state 0 or state 1 by squaring the alpha and beta that correspond to B.
So, and now I'll talk about one more quantum circuit. Quantum teleportation uses a 3-qubit system to transmit a 1-qubit message while sending only 2 classical bits. The circuit requires Alice and Bob to share a pair of entangled bits that you can see here. So, after Alice leaves, so goes to her location where she can transmit the message, she processes the entangled bit along with her message qubit here through this gate, which yields a pair of classical bits here. And then she can send Bob. Now, this process allows Bob to recover quantum information solely from transmitted classical bits. The physical circuit design for quantum teleportation is illustrated by this poster itself, with each block of text representing an element or gate in the circuit.
Although the description of a quantum computer and two bits, they're very cool and can make our lives that much easier, there are practical problems and issues that we have to deal with. One of them is called decoherence. And decoherence results from the environment interfering with the quantum properties of the quantum computer. For example, vibrations and nuclear spin of the components used in the making of the quantum computer. That is all. Thank you very much.
poster was that?
Yeah, you guys will also be able to circulate your posters to ask questions too. That's great. All right. Any other volunteer? All right. Guys, ready? Take it away.
Hey, we're quantum gravity or thinking quantum with Armando Barak.
Yeah, so essentially our project was, we learned about a bunch of things. We learned about quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, quantum gravity. We discussed a few thought experiments, and basically we got all of our questions clarified about anything we wanted in physics. So we'll just teach you a bit about what we learned. So we'll start with what states and operators are. So these are a part of quantum mechanics. A state is essentially some quantity which describes the system. Right? So this is an abstract mathematical object. It's not something which we can simply write as, say, a number or a vector. However, in certain simple cases, we can say that a state can sometimes be represented by a vector. An operator is somewhat similar. An operator acts on a state and transforms it into a different state. Now, again, in certain very simple cases, an operator is represented as a matrix. And say if we have an operator which is represented by the matrix A, B, C, D, it can operate on a simple form of a state, x, y, and that gets transformed into another state, say x dash, y dash. Right? So this is how states and operators work. And now we'll introduce the concept of what an eigenstate is. Suppose you have some eigenstate, and now we're going to introduce the notation called the Bra-Ket notation, where you have, this is what we call a bra. You have some quantity inside the bra. I'm sorry, this is a ket. So it has a line on the left-hand side and a kind of angle on the right-hand side. And what this means is that this represents the state, right? And now we have something called a bra, which is similar, except you have the line over here, and you have the quantity, and then you have the angle on the left-hand side. Now, how are these two related? Well, suppose we have a quantity that is a state represented by a ket. Then what is represented by this? This bra is essentially the complex conjugate transpose of this ket, right? So that's how these two are related, and that's how we'll be using this notation. Now, an eigenstate is essentially what you get when, suppose you have an operator, a position operator, which operates on some state x, and this gives you a constant scalar x naught multiplied by the same state. Now, if this equation is true, we can say that the state x is an eigenstate of the operator x hat. And we can say that x naught is a scalar, which is known as the eigenvalue of this state. Superposition is another concept which we use, which is essentially taking a linear combination of several states and equating that to a more general state.
All right, so I'll talk really quickly about creation and annihilation operators. So there are specific types of operators that can act on states to create and annihilate particles, and these are called creation and annihilation operators. Creation operator is denoted by a dagger, and it can act on the state, say the vacuum state, to produce a state with one particle. And then you have the annihilation operator, which can act on a state with one particle to produce the vacuum state. So in quantum field theory, in classical theory, we have what is known as scalars, and we have scalar fields, which basically assigns a scalar value, a number, at every single point in the space. In quantum field theory, we promote those scalars to operators. So in a sense, you have an operator field, which assigns an operator to every single point in the space. And so this is a sort of creation annihilation operator. And using Fourier transformations and cool stuff, essentially what you can do is you can act the creation annihilation operator on a vacuum, and we can get a particle with a position particle or an energy particle. And essentially, from relativity, what we get is that a position vector is defined in terms of four components, one of time and then three of space. And using Fourier transformations, we can get sort of an equivalent vector in terms of its energy and momentums, big momentums. And so this operator acts on the vacuum state, and you can produce a particle with a position p at a specific time, or a position x or yz at a specific time, or momentum p with a given energy. So that's
OK. Let's talk about the attraction of two particles. Okay, assume the initial momentum of two particles is 1p and 1p and 1q. So after reaction, the momentum transfer turns into k and l. These terms, called coupling terms, present the number of reactions the particle undergoes, and the power that phi is raised to represent the number of lines that connect to this vertex. And for example, this diagram, there are three lines attached to one vertex, so it's raised to the power of three, and there are two reactions because there are two vertexes, so there are two terms multiplied together. And okay, now in reality, we cannot know what's happening in the middle. The particles can follow any of the possible paths if we use M1 to M3 and so on to represent the possibility of each path being used. The equation would be the probability equation saying how likely it is for the overall reaction to occur. Okay, some of the paths include the creation and annihilation of particles. These are called virtual particles because we cannot know if they will actually appear or not. Because we don't detect them, we can only put the possibility of them appearing in our sound probabilities.
Okay. Just building off this, we're trying to make it really fast because I think we're running out of time. So basically building off of this, you can get kind of a probability distribution for what you're doing, for what you have, say, so here are your basically points in space-time, x and y. And so we know that it's going to start basically at x or y and then go to the other one. But there's an infinite number of interactions that you can have in the middle. But to represent this, we can basically draw the Feynman diagrams for each different order, which is basically how many interactions you're going to have in the middle. So we can end up with a lot of different diagrams. For example, for the zeroth order, you just have x going to y. But then you can keep going and get x going to A going to Y, and A goes to itself, because I'm going to just do this really fast. You've got basically all of your A's in the middle, and using combination, you essentially have to contract all of your phi's, and by contracting these, you can get all your different possible combinations, and you end up with your probability distribution.
Well, do people want the 20-second version of quantum gravity?
Yes.
Okay, God. Well, we must see from turning gravity to a full quantum idea. However, if we keep the space-time stuff within the classical ideas and we turn energy and momentum into a sort of a quantum theory, we can get a semi-classical theory which sort of works. Now, one thing we can find from a semi-classical theory is that Unruh, I pronounced it correct. No, Unruh, I'm so sorry. Which tells you that particles are not objective, they are subjective. The person next time rated in an accelerating state of motion will see a bunch of particles appearing out of nowhere. The person who was kind of at constant speed or staying still, depending on who you want to ask, will see none. At this point, we kind of need to explain the Hawking radiation from a dark hole because you're accelerating away from it, so you don't want to die. And if we see a bunch of particles appearing out of nowhere, and you can go on with this to show that the black hole's temperature is inversely proportional to its mass, and that, well, the stuff we just saw in class today about entropy being related to the surface area.
If you want to check that stuff out, please come and see our project.
Awesome, guys. Jonathan, you should have finished off all the lectures that I did.
In general relativity, space is curved, and it's kind of difficult to do math on curved space because it gets really messy. And so we can use something called manifolds, which is the basic idea that if you look close enough at a curve, it'll just seem flat, like you get really, really zoomed in on it. But manifolds have to be really tiny because... Spoilers. If you have a big manifold and you try and wrap it around the curve, you can't do it without warping the flat space, and then you have to do weird math, and I don't understand it, so. But we use smaller manifolds, and if this is really exaggerated, but you can see that it's much smoother, and so we're able to get more of a curve. And this makes it so that we can do math on curved space.
We're talking about geophysics, and basically geophysics in general relativity is it describes, it generalizes the straight line to a curve. So gravity is no more a force, but it becomes a consequence of space-time curvature. So as you can see here in this diagram, this is the 5D dimension diagram. And so the uncertain relativity is used in ABC to solve a problem in CFT using uncertain relativity.
With all this mathematical machinery behind it, the main equation of general relativity is the Einstein's equation, and it summarizes 10 complete equations, and it's a wave equation that you can see here. Well, there, but it includes the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar that tells you how is the curvature, and then we have the metric and the cosmological constant, and then in the right part of this equation we can see the stress energy tensor that tells you about the matter. If we develop this equation in a vacuum, we assume that we assume that this right part of the equation is zero, then we can do math and we arrive at this simple equation that it's the simple of that
when you solve that equation, it's very difficult to solve But when you do solve it, you can solve it for some simple black holes. So that's what we did here. We have three simple solutions that people have come up with. The first one is the Schwarzschild solution. It describes a really simple black hole, like it's not moving, it's not charged, it's not rotating in any way. So when you solve the Einstein equation, you get a metric, which pretty much defines length in whatever curved space-time you're using. So here's the metric for the Schwarzschild solution, which is what we have on the board. And then with this solution, you get pretty much a single singularity and then a single event variety.
Here we have a diagram that represents the solution, and it shows two universes that are parallel. And we have the singularity here and another singularity here that is a white hole that is a singularity that.
It's pretty much the opposite of a black hole, where if you get the light that comes from a singularity, but it can't go back to the singularity instead of coming to the singularity and not back.
Okay, so now that we know about the Schwarzschild solution, we should probably know what a black hole actually looks like. So, when you have a big star and it gets to the end of its lifetime, so it runs out of fuel, what happens is if it's really massive, and the particles don't have enough repulsive force, so there's a lot of gravity, and the repulsive force is not strong enough to keep it from collapsing onto itself, all the mass will collapse into one single point, which we call the singularity. Now, space close to this point is going to be really curved, and it's going to be really distorted, so it actually bends light really, it deflects light really strongly. That's a terrible wording. And there's actually a region of space in which if light travels there, it won't actually be able to escape. So that is called the event horizon. Any region inside the event horizon will pull light into it no matter what. And we can take this equation and do a bunch of math and realize that the event horizon is at r equals 2 times the mass of the black hole. You can see it on our poster up here. And, yeah, so anything that's inside here will not be able to come out. And there's also another region called the photosphere. And this region is, as light gets close to the singularity or the black hole, it distorts a lot. And the photosphere is just a region in which if light starts at the photosphere, it can actually orbit around perfectly. And the equation for that is r equals 3m.
Okay, so the second solution we have is the Reister-Nordström solution, and it has a different metric, which I'm not going to write down because it's kind of boring, but it depends on this factor delta. You can see it on this graph. So that goes to that, and if you move that, it's equal 0 for the event horizon. So if you rearrange that, you get it. Which pretty much looks like a quadratic. So if this part, the determinant, is 0, you get a single horizon. If it's real, so it's greater than this part is greater than 1, greater than 0. You get two horizons and a singularity, and if it's equals, if it's imaginary, then you get zero horizons, which is a naked singularity, which you can't have.
Okay. So now we have discussed such a solution. Because the simple black hole, we can actually try and use it to run simulations. This is a simulation I found on some computer programming community. So right now, if we have an angular momentum, which is quite small, you can see the trajectory that the particle would take. Oops, sorry. Wrong. So, 3. You can see the trajectory that a particle, such as a planet, or an asteroid, would take around the black hole. So the curve would eventually fall straight in. Now, if we actually increase this, we can go and have a better trajectory. Would you like? So the particle will actually start to orbit the black hole without never getting into it, but just spinning around. And Like, if you want to see more details and more situations, you can come to our poster presentation downstairs. Come and see us. I have them on at least two computers. I can show in video.
Thank you.
What happened.
Another STEM, it was one of the concepts we learned, and it basically describes the connection between different symmetries and conservation laws. So specifically, it says that every differential symmetry of a physical system's action has a corresponding conservation law. So this was proposed by Emmy Noether, who was a German mathematician known for her work in abstract algebra and theoretical physics. And a few examples of this theorem are that translational symmetry causes the conservation of momentum. Rotational symmetry causes the conservation of angular momentum. Free symmetry, which is the symmetry through a change in velocity, causes the conservation of the center of mass. And time translation symmetry causes the conservation of energy. But because our universe has evolved from a singularity, the time translational symmetry is broken, so that there is no conservation of energy. And that a constant vacuum energy causes increases overall energy as space expands.
Okay, CPT is actually three different symmetries. CPT. T symmetry is probably the easiest to understand. It's just what happens whenever you take all the momenta of, or you basically switch everything around so it goes backwards in time. And that's accomplished by taking all of the four vectors and doing the opposite of the zero component, which is the time component. And it is respected by gravity and electromagnetism, which are the forces we commonly interact with, so it seems natural. P symmetry is parity, which basically just means mirror image symmetry. That's what happens if you flip things like a mirror. So like a car that steering wheel on the right to a car steering wheel left can't be rotated into each other, they're actually physically distinct. And it's also respected, but like gravity doesn't care, and electromagnetism respect this symmetry, so they seem natural. And C symmetry stands for charge, but it's really particle antiparticle symmetry, which means you're taking a complex conjugate of your spinners, and it just means if you replace all the particles with their antiparticles, the system will fall the same. And it turns out they're actually not true. The weak force violates all of them. It doesn't violate T. It violates charge and parity, and also charge and parity together, which is... So it violates parity because neutrinos only spin right or left. Right, so that's how it also violates C. But then it seems like if you put them together at the same time, like you do the antiparticles and you do a mirror image, then it would be true, but then it turns out also not to work. The strong force obeys CP symmetry, at least what we've measured, which is kind of a mystery. And one idea is that there might be some field called the axion, which is a dark matter candidate, which keeps the strong force obeying CP symmetry.
right? CPT altogether is doing all three at the same time. And that basically has to be true because of the way that quantum field theory is done. For example, if CPT symmetry was not true, then you might have to like mess up the Lorentz symmetry, which is the symmetry of changing your frame of reference.
Okay, so here, we kind of use symmetry to derive like the equation for special relativity instead of using the speed of light as a constant. So here was like, we did the sound experiment, kind of to assume there's like a lot of different factors, like there's 10 variables, and we used first, we see it from the platform's perspective, then we see it from the plane's perspective, and we use the time variables and six equations to derive the relationship between W, V, and R. And from this, we use symmetry to flip on the different variables, and we reach another equation. And then we use these two equations to kind of get to the result here. And where we kind of use v squared by v squared, so we kind of crossed it out. And then we got this constant, which is, in fact, we found out to be the speed of light. And here, so we derived the equation for the relativistic factor, which is the same one that we got from assuming that the speed of light is a constant. So we basically just used the simple mathematical trick with symmetry to reach like this fun fact about special relativity.
Okay, and I'm going to try and distill hours of linear algebra down to the basics of why symmetry can help model the basics of the standard model. So the Lagrangian of the standard model represents an energy density, which can be shown to have the units of electron volts to the power of 4 by substituting the basic units. This unit is what we're looking for the elements of Lagrangian. So we can piece together our Lego pieces of the elements of our universe, and we can represent scalars with the notation Greek letter phi as elements with spin 0 representing bosons and units of electron volts to the power of 1. Spinners usually representing fermions with spin plus or minus a half, represented by the Greek letter psi, with units of electron volts to the 3 over 2, which can be shown through a more complex mathematical derivation. And vectors with the letter A, spins 1 or negative 1, are representing a boson, electron volts to 1 by definition. So by piecing these together with a couple other elements, like a 4-vector derivative and mass, you can get the elements that are included in the Lagrangian of the standard model. There is some symmetry involved, such as that one of the elements doesn't work because of gauge invariance, which necessitates in a gauge transformation that our residual mass terms not vary. So a couple terms don't actually work, but this still gives you the general idea of what you're looking for elements of the standard model.
Okay, yeah. So now I'll try to also distill what we did for supersymmetry, which apparently a lot of us thought was the topic of this, but no. So anyway, supersymmetry is basically about a transformation, which is a spinner-like transformation, which will allow us to convert between fermions and bosons, more specifically from a Gibbs boson to a fermion vice versa, and a fermion to a scalar field vice versa, with the different helicities, which are the size of the spins. So supersymmetry was created to solve some, it's used now to solve some mathematical problems in computing, like quantum systems. And it also reconciles some problems with string theory, like reducing the number of dimensions from an absolutely large number to like 10, which is good, apparently. So now let's move on to how a supersymmetry works. It works using a spinner-like operator, which allows us to make changes in bosonic fields using fermionic fields. And so the problem is that supersymmetry is broken in our low energy states, and so yeah, that's what the Large Hadron Collider is trying to see whether it works in high energies, and not yet. So yeah, that's about it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, floor is yours. Go for it.
So, welcome to Quantum Classical Chaos. We learned a huge amount in our project about how quantum systems evolve, what's the chaotic systems, how we can interplay between them. And generally, our project can be summarized in four main phases. The first of which is just we wanted to study the motion of a classical particle in an irregular shaped box, just to kind of see how classical chaos evolves over time. Then we wanted to use a point array map, which is a way of kind of analyzing the system, to identify the chaos within the system. Once we had established that, we wanted to see how we could do this in quantum mechanics, so apply the quantum mechanics to the system, and in using the different energy levels and the distribution, kind of actually analyze quantum chaos. And that brings us to the last part, which was to try and see if we could actually find the quantum chaos pattern in our simulation.
All right, so for a little bit of background, chaos theory is essentially the mathematical study of dynamical systems in which a small perturbation in the initial conditions leads to a large divergence in the final conditions. And so for there to be chaos, the initial trajectories of particles in the system have to diverge exponentially as time goes on. And to model our dynamical system, we used a series of parametric differential equations to create a boundary, essentially a box which contains the particles, and such that all the points along the boundary of the box correspond to points along a Poincaré section in phase space. And so we can use this to model classical chaos by we took the dynamical system and modeled it in Mathematica. And in order to discover if there is chaos in the system, we have to look at the Poincaré map and determine if there are any patterns in where the points show up on the Poincaré map. And if there is a pattern, it's not chaotic. But if there's no pattern, or not a noticeable pattern, then it is chaotic.
So we constructed our classical system using some inventive and intensive mathematics. So the system which we constructed consists of four major quantities. So we have an initial position, we have a final position of our particle in the box, as well as we have P and PI and PF, which describe the initial and final momentum of this particle. So essentially, in this particular system, we assume that energy is conserved, so the magnitude of the momentums would be equal. And introducing this constraint, we reduced our phase space to a dimensionality of 3. And therefore, there were 3 major parameters which we had to describe in this particular system, those being the initial position, the final position, and the momentum. And we did this by introducing 2 quantities, theta and alpha, where theta defines the position of this particle when it hits the boundary of our irregular two-dimensional shape, such that theta is an element from 0 to set from 0 to 2 pi. And alpha defines the angle that's associated with the momentum vector with respect to the horizontal. And when we constructed this classical system, we were also able to develop a mathematical framework for and devise an algorithm for the particular simulation we ran for the classical system. So, like Lachlan mentioned, we defined the external boundary for our irregular two-dimensional shape by a set of parametric equations. We then differentiated these sets of parametric equations and applied an inverse tangent function to find the angle beta describing the angle between the trajectory with respect to the horizontal. And therefore, we could compute an updated value for the angle of incidence alpha 2. And given this, we can update the position of our particle as it bounces off this boundary and hits the next position along the boundary. And hence, we were able to set up sort of a iterative algorithm which is able to calculate the trajectory of this particle in the box.
And when we map the trajectories of the particles, you can see here we have our boundary of the box, and inside we see the lines mapping the trajectory that the particle takes. And so we were able to deform the boundary by using a coefficient of lambda. And so the greater the lambda value, the greater the deformation of the circle. So for the first one, we have lambda equal to 0.01, so it's just a very slight deformation. And we see that the trajectory of the particle follows a fairly distinct pattern, representing the fact that it is not necessarily a chaotic system because it does not diverge exponentially if you add another particle. But here, we have it more chaotic because we have a lambda value of 0.03. And you can see that it is a chaotic system, but you still have some form of pattern almost along the edges. So it's kind of the transition between chaos and a non-chaotic system. And then our last one has an even larger lambda value of 0.05, and you can see that the trajectory is completely chaotic inside the boundary.
Although we can see intuitively how the path changes from integral system to chaotic system, we cannot tell accurately why that is so. In order to represent an accurate portrait of how chaotic the system is, we need to plot the points in the phase space. The phase space is shown essentially is just a linear section, and then we're trying to find out whether the points on the phase space has a pattern. So the blue line corresponds to this system where lambda is equal to a point 0.01, and then we can see that this integral system, and clearly the line is a pretty straightforward pattern. And then if you look at the pink one, which corresponds to lambda value 0.03, you get a little bit more chaos, but you still see these ring structures. And then when we reach lambda value 0.05, it gets completely chaotic. And you see these purple dots spread out over phase space. And then at this point, we can conclude that the purple system is chaotic.
OK, so I'm just going to compare quantum or classical chaos really quickly. So basically, the main difference between an integrable, which is a non-chaotic system, and a chaotic system is that an integrable system, the nearby trajectories actually stay and stay together, whereas for chaotic, as Walker said, I think, they start out small, but they diverge exponentially. And also, going to the quantum system, the spacing of the energy levels of a non-chaotic quantum system, it actually follows a Poisson distribution, as you can see over here and over here. I think someone will talk about that later. And the spacing for a spacing of energy levels for a chaotic quantum system follows the Whittaker distribution, which you can see over here.
So yeah, for our model, we actually wanted to take the original classical kind of structure where we had the kind of irregular shaped circle, and we wanted to translate that into a quantum system where there was a single particle acting as a wave. And then once we did that, we were able to see whether or not we actually got a Wigner distribution or a Poisson distribution based on how transformed the actual shape was.
So we got our two-dimensional system mathematical model from our one-dimensional mathematical model. And we'll apply Hamiltonian operator to the wave function to get this equation. That is psi, and it's equal to the whole function. And we wanted to model psi with two signs, the product of two signs, because we use one sign for a 1D mathematical model. And we're going to take, so this vector, we still ignore it because it's going to be equal to 1. And we take negative sign to the side. And we want the two partial derivatives of this equation. So we took the partial derivatives and we get minus alpha squared n here. Minus alpha squared psi, and then we get minus beta squared psi. So this whole term, alpha and beta, the sum of these two is going to be equal to the energy.
And we were able to analyze various different systems, detect to see if we found quantum chaos or not. And for more details of that, please check in with us then. Thank you for your time.
So, I'm sure that everyone is kind of tired of poster presentations, so we're not doing a poster presentation.
This is a disgrace.
Look, Blackpool, I think you need to calm down.
Calm down? Cool down? Seriously? You're saying that to me? How am I even supposed to cool down? I mean, I'm doing everything you wanted me to do, and now you want to replace me?
Look, I'm not trying to replace you.
Listen, no. Okay, so, look at all my records, boss. I'm on top of mass about this. I'm the best you have.
You're doing a good job, seriously, but it's just not enough. You're qualified to act as dark matter and everything, but it's more than you're able to do.
More than I'm able to do? And what about all of these stars rotating around me? Well, I know that.
Yes, but you're just not big enough to be responsible for their high velocities. You need to bring in more dark matter to help you out with your responsibilities. I'm sorry, it's not your fault, but the evidence is there. There's nothing I can do. We need to bring more matter in to make the equations make sense.
Well, go ahead with it.
What are we going to do? It's just so difficult to find someone like black holes. Guess we better start the interviews. All right, here comes the first candidate. Come on in. Hi.
Hi.
So, it's Axians, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about your credentials.
Well, I mean, just to begin with, I have zero. I've spin zero. No charge and weak electromagnetic interaction. So, like, I can't really think of a universe that wouldn't want to take me on as dark matter.
Go on.
Well, I mean, as I'm sure you're aware, I could actually account for the additional charge clarity violations that Cody explained earlier that would account for the existence of more matter than antimatter in our universe today. Just to say, like, no biggie or whatever.
Wow, that's very impressive. If it's true.
Well, I mean, like, my references, like, oh, I mean, I'm working on them. Like, it's close to proving my existence. It's like this really narrow range of masses that I could occupy. So, like, with this.
To prove that you're not existence.
Well, I mean, you could see it that way. Or you could see it that, like, we're this close to proving that I'm in there.
Oh, let's hope that that works out for you. But unfortunately, I can't employ anyone with no confirmed references. Come back with evidence for your existence, and we'd be happy to take you on.
I knew you were going to say that. I don't understand why I have to prove myself to everyone.
Well, that went well. Here come the wimps. Literally. So, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, we are so massively attracted. We have no charge, no color, and we basically don't decay. And we can actually be the lowest energy supersymmetric particles for the standard model, the particles of the standard model. We are basically endorsed by so many physicists.
Yeah, but so is supersymmetry, and just look at how that went.
Right, yeah. We were friends, but, we knew each other once, but we're not that close. Like, if you want us to forget them, that's no problem. Say the word, it's a thing of the past. Super who?
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. You don't have to completely abandon symmetry. It's just nice to hear that you can exist independently.
Oh yeah, we can totally do that. And you can totally check us out. We can check us out through the collider search, through the indirect search, the direct search. We're like super legit.
Oh, so you have experience in experiments.
Yeah, just look at the decay of the Z-bosons.
Yeah, that didn't work.
You heard about that. Well, there are other collider searches still happening, and they're trying to look for us through missing energy.
And they still haven't found you.
And our indirect searches for our decay products, gamma ray photons, cosmic rays, that stuff's quantifiable. Like Comptel, Vgrad, Integral, and Magic. Someone's bound to find us soon, right? Right? I mean, we've got magic on our side.
Right. Well, we'll see about that. You've got a bit of a reputation for ambiguous results. Burn me up.
You don't even
even know what that was.
Well, we touch. All right, well, that's the end of it. Now I just have a meeting with one of the executives. Gravity, how are you?
Well, I'm all right. I'm feeling a little shaky, to be honest. How were the meetings?
Well, there were some promising candidates, but none of them were entirely rock solid.
Well, maybe I'm the problem.
Don't say that!
I mean, it's just what some of the doctors have been saying, that I might never have been right to begin with. Maybe we need to change from the top down. But, you know, like putting in a new equation for long distances.
But that wouldn't account for gravitational lensing.
Well, just throw in a new field, some constants. You know how it goes. If it fits, it sticks.
but we need you. Losing you would mean changing everything. And wouldn't you need to add a whole other field to do that? That's crazy talk. You're challenging everything.
Isn't that what Einstein did? Sometimes you have to accept that an idea falls flat on its face, or the ground accelerates to its face.
Have I wasted all this time? Could dark matter really be that fundamental? I guess we have a lot to think about. Great.